Hello, Earthlets. I have a confession to make. I lied to you. In the last Thrillcast, I said we'd be back in a month's time, and, well, that's patently not true.
Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic, this is the 2000 AD Thrillcast!
Borag Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to another episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I know we said we'd be a month away, but we just couldn't keep away from your aural receptors. We've got a fantastic episode for you this week with a couple of special guests where we're going to be talking a bit more about 2000 AD in general rather than concentrating just on the Judge Dredd Mega Collection, because I think the one thing that everybody has really fed back, and it's something that we wanted to do, was to broaden this out to make it truly the 2000 AD Thrillcast. So we're going to be touching on what's in 2000 AD at the moment. If you want to keep up on a weekly basis with everything that's happening 2000 AD-wise, then I recommend you subscribe to the 2000 AD Thrill Mail. If you go to our website at www.2000adonline.com, there is a link on there for you to go to enter your details. Every Wednesday, the Thrill Mail makes its way into your inbox with all the latest news, announcements, new products, new titles, a free comic. Things like a classic cover and links to online news stories about 2000 AD, Galaxy's greatest comic. So, you're listening to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. What is 2000 AD? Well, if you're not picking it up, then to be quite frank, you're missing out. It's a weekly anthology comic that's published both in print and digitally. It's available through newsagents and comic book stores. It's available through our website and through our apps for the iPad and Android devices. It is so much more than just the home of Judge Dredd. Over the past 38 years, we've brought you some of the greatest characters by some of the all-time greatest creators, people who've gone on to define modern comic books, and that has not stopped as our mission. If you want to know who's going to be dominating comics over the next few years, then 2000 AD is the place to find them. And it's a pleasure to welcome Matt Smith, the editor of 2000 AD, back into the Thrillcast studio to talk about Prog 1924, which came out a couple of weeks ago and was our big jumping on point for new readers and for people who've perhaps not read us for a few years. Matt, welcome back to the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Hello.
We've had a jumping on issue, so it's the ideal point for new and lapsed readers to come on board. Tell us a little bit about the stories that people can pick up in 2000 AD right now.
In Prog 1924, whole bunch of new stories start. First of all, we've got Judge Dredd Enceladus, which is a sequel to the story Titan that ran at the beginning of 2014. By Rob Williams and Henry Flynn, and again Rob and Henry have collaborated on this new story that picks up some of the plot threads from the last story, where in the original story Dredd leads a team to the Saturn moon of Titan, which is where the judges are sent to prison because there's been a they've lost contact with it, and it turns out there's been a prison outbreak that was led by an old character from Dredd's past, which, in case anybody listening to this hasn't read the original story, I don't want to spoil. this new story starting in 1924 picks up on some of the elements from that, and you know, a mysterious ship is coming towards Mega City 1 from Enceladus, which is another of Saturn's moons. So there's some mystery involved around that, and this villain from Dredd's past will be back making a nuisance of themselves. And we also have Strontium Dog, the Sticks Fix, by John and Carlos.
The original creators on Strontium Dog.
Yes. Still the original team. Still going. This is after all the revolutionary series that have been going on for the past couple of years, where Dredd's led a mutant revolution against the norms. This is more of a kind of a regular case for
Dredd. Did you just say Dredd or Alpha?
Did I say Dredd?
I think you said Dread.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. I'll take Tharglav words. Yes, Johnny Alpha led a revolution. So this is more of a regular case for Johnny, where he's hired to find somebody who's been kidnapped. And we also have The Return of Slane, which is the second book of the Britannia Chronicles. Again, picking up from the first series which ran last year, again by Pat Mills and Simon Davis, where Dredd's fighting the Droon Lords on the Isle of Mandad.
That's got that incredible Simon Davis artwork.
More amazing double page spreads from Simon.
We're going to be talking to both Simon and Pat later in the in this episode of the Thrillcast. One of the things we talked to them about is how reinvigorated the strip feels since Simon came on board. There's a kind of a, and not that it was bored and tired beforehand, but there's a kind of new vitality to it.
One thing Pat's very good at is writing for artists and giving artists what they want to draw. Mm. And Simon originally came to Pat with ideas. He's always wanted to draw Slane, and he's one of his favourite characters, and so he came to Pat with ideas about bringing in giants and various kind of artistic influences, and so Pat came up with this idea of where he wanted to take Slane, and very much writing to Simon's strengths. Mm-hmm. and it shows in Simon's artwork. You can feel he's putting every inch of his imagination and every love into the pages. So it's some of his finest work.
And in the rest of the prog, we've got two strips that might not be known to people who are long term lapsed readers, but though one of the characters may well be very familiar to them.
Orlok should be familiar to any long term squacks. Arthur Wyatt, the writer, and Jake Lynch, the artist, have done a previous series of Orlok stories, and this is the second one. It's kind of like if James Bond was a Russian agent and spy. These are the kind of adventures he might get up to. So this is Orlok sort of prior to when we first met him in Blockmania. Mm. This is what he gets up to in his day job.
Anyone who listened to our podcast about the Apocalypse War volume of the Judge Dredd Mega Collection will be familiar with Orlok as a character and as a catalyst for chaos in Mega City 1. And then we've got Dan Abnett. Now, Dan is known far beyond the pages of 2000 AD. Thanks to his work on Guardians of the Galaxy and Warhammer, and the series that he's doing for us, Grey Area, that's a surprising return for that strip, isn't it? Because as far as we were concerned, at the end of the last series, everything had ended.
Everything blew up. Grey Area, if anyone doesn't know, is this series kind of about alien immigration. There's this huge holding area on Earth where aliens have to go through if they want to come to Earth, and it's policed by these armed squads of soldier stroke police. And we've had sort of two previous series of that, and then at the end of the last series, this huge interplanetary God Star was approaching Earth with a view to gobbling it up, and the squad of Grey Air officers went out and blew it up, and that's the last we saw of them. Now, the third series, which opens in 1924, finds them in a very different place altogether, and it sort of takes the series into a bit of a left field. You'll have to read it to see where they are, what happened to them.
So, a couple of times there, we've mentioned that we've got recurring characters, and when people hear about recurring characters, they often think, I need to have read everything beforehand to pick up on this. But what's been surprising about 1924, and we have these regular jumping on issues, but what's been really nice about 1924 is, even though we've got a couple of sequels in there, everything still feels really accessible, especially Enceladus, the Dredd story. Even though it's a direct sequel to another story, you're kind of straight in there with all the information you need, which is a great thing for Rob Williams, the writer, to have done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, he'd hope to make it as easy to pick up as possible. Mm. You know, there's nothing worse than reading a story and you have absolutely no idea who anyone is, and it's referring to stuff that you've never heard of. and also to help with that, this 1924 includes a catch up page before each of the stories. So that gives you a pretty comprehensive rundown of who the characters are and what's been the build up to this particular story. So it should get you on board if you're unfamiliar with them. Mm.
We've not done that for a long time. I remember seeing those kind of pages in the 1990s. What made you want to bring them back?
Well, I mean, partly because usually for these jumping on progs, we have an extra 4 pages to play with. That's given us the room to do them. I mean, part of the reason you can't do them in the regular prog is this isn't the room. Mm. I mean, we have the Nerve Center page and on the inside front cover every week, which gives you a kind of very very small capsule, just letting you know who these characters are. But for the title pages, you can go into a bit more detail about what's happened previously. Mm. I mean. They would be nice to do every week, but as I said, there isn't the room. But with 1924, I made a effort for people not to feel lost, because there is a lot of there's a lot of stuff out there that's gone on previously. So I'm trying to make it as easy enough for people to sort of slide into it.
Sure. Well, the feedback that I've seen has been fantastic. You know, we've had coverage on the Hollywood Reporter website. We've had coverage from all the usual comic sites, which has been fantastic. As editor for many years now of 2000 AD, does it help you to have these jumping on points is just a kind of a pause and a reinvigoration, a push forward?
I mean, it just makes sense, really, because I mean, when you're planning out the issue, for the first couple of months of 2015, I knew that Dark Justice was going to be 11 episodes long, The Order was going to be 12 episodes long, Savage was going to be 13 episodes long. So when you're seeing that all these stories are finishing around the particular point, you just think, well, I might as well have all the new stories start in the same issue, rather than having Strontium Dog start a couple of issues before something else starts. And it just makes a very easy prog to kind of market to people, to say, if you want to start reading 2000 AD, this is a very good point to jump in, rather than saying, well, this story's going to start in this issue, but if you hang on for another 2 weeks, another story's going to start. Yeah. It's just a matter of kind of organising the stories around particular points in the schedule which make the most sense.
When this podcast goes out, we're going to be on to Prog 1926, yeah, which will be the second one after the jumping on issue. Enceladus in 1925 has some wonderful character moments by Henry Flint. There's some lovely wordplay, as always, from Dan Abnett, and Slane continues to be amazing. If someone were to say to you, why should I pick up 2000 AD now? I've seen it in my newsagents. Why should I pick it up now? What would you say to them?
I'll just say the amazing quality of writing and art in the current lineup should be no reason why you want to pick it up. You just a flick through of the current issues, and you see artwork by Carlos and Henry and Simon and Mark Harrison and Jake, and you just think, oh, this is pretty amazing stuff. This is some of our writers and artists at the top of their games, if you want to get 2000 AD, now's a perfect time to see it at its best.
Yeah. So everyone's got a starting point, whether it was Prog number one or Prog 1924 from the other week. What was your first Prog, Matt?
My first Prog was Prog 412, back in 1985. No great reason for why that had to be that particular prog. It was just I used to get the Eagle, and was getting a bit fed up with it because it was getting a bit rubbish. Mm. So I just decided to try 2000 AD, and that happened to be the prog that happened to be out that week. And it wasn't a great. It was an enjoyable prog, but it wasn't a great prog to kind of get into, because you're about three or so episodes away from the end of Halo Jones Book 2, about a couple of episodes into Slain Time Killer. About a third, about two thirds of the way through Hell Trekkers, and added one off Dread. So there's no great kind of, you know, help in trying to work out what was going on in most of the stories. But I didn't mind. You know, I was 12, as soon as I started reading 2008, I immediately felt this was a much more sophisticated comic than I was used to reading. Artwork felt so much stronger and so much more vibrant and so much more violent, and the stories felt so more mature and better written. That I immediately fell in love with it, and it didn't help that I had no idea why these barbarians in Slain were firing laser guns and stuff like that. It looked cool. And then a few months after I started reading the weekly prog, the best of 2000 AD started, and that just filled in a huge amount of gaps over the next few years as I picked up all the classics.
I think you've given exactly the perfect example of how easy it is to get into 2000 AD. So even though you started at a random point, the quality on offer there was enough to keep you ensnared. I mean, my first issue was the first one after Necropolis had ended, the huge great big Judge Dredd epic with the Dark Judges, and it was a one-off Dredd story. And like you, I hadn't got a damn clue what the hell was going on, but it was enjoyable enough and intriguing enough and so well drawn and everything. And the rest of the stories were amazing that it gripped, I wanted to know more. I wanted to fill in those gaps like the best of 2008 monthly helped me immeasurably with that.
Back in those days, there wasn't the huge wealth of graphic novel collections that we've got now. Anyone who wants to get into Dredd or Strontium Dog or any of the 2000 characters can pop along to the comic shop or bookshop and pick up these huge telephone directory size collections and they can have the whole series laid out in front of them. But back in the 80s, you had to rely on a few meager collections maybe that might be coming out or the best of 2000 AD.
We're talking about the point at which we started reading 2000 AD, but when did you start reading 2000 AD? Tell us your treasured memories about your first prog, whether it was 30 years ago or whether it was last week. Send them through to thrillcast@2000adonline.com, which is our new email address, or tweet us on Twitter. At 2000 AD, and let us know what was the prog that got you into 2000 AD. Matt, thank you so much for joining us again on the Thrillcast. I'm sure we'll have you back in the future.
No problem. Thank you.
So joining us at the 2000 AD Nerve Center, we have the amazing artist on Slain Primordial, Mr. Simon Davis. Welcome to the Nerve Center, Simon.
Thank you.
So we're talking about the new Slain series, which is running in 2000 AD at the moment. This is your second go on Slain after a simple killing.
Yeah.
Bit of a departure from previous incarnations, a return to fully painted artwork. On Slain, tell us a bit about how you came to be working on the series.
2013 was sort of my 20th anniversary of working for 2000.
Wow.
So I thought it'd be quite nice to mark that by doing something really good. Not that everything else hopefully hasn't been, but I thought the perfect strip for that is Slain, and when I first wanted to work for 2000, Slain was my sort of entry into it with the Bisley stuff, and then from that sort of going back and looking at the McMahon and the Fabry and stuff. So, and I'd worked with Pat on Black Cedar and another thing that didn't see the light of day for Cool Beans. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, but working with Pat was quite fun, actually. And really enjoyable experience, and he's such a nice chap. So I emailed him and said, look, if Slain comes, there comes a point where I could work on Slain, that would be great. And he seemed pretty keen about that. So I think I'm not sure, but I think Clint had naturally come to the end of his sort of
his tenure on it.
Yeah, I think he'd done all he could do on it.
And he still,
you know, I didn't want to do somebody out of a job, but and he still had ABC worries and
sure
and stuff like that. So it wasn't like I was being underhand about it all. But so then we just started to and throwing ideas and sort of and I think the sort of thought was trying to get Slane back to a little bit more sort of world weary and a little bit back to sort of the McMahon sort of things.
He's a bit of a wanderer.
And a bit I'm all for a simplicity with storytelling and
so we
were quite keen to keep it like that and then just get it back to having monsters and myths and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, which is and sort of root it into the countryside again and, and stuff and so he was pretty amenable to that.
Now you've mentioned some of the greats there who've not only worked on Slane but also for 2000 AD, Simon Bisley, Mick McMahon, Glenn Fabry. What was it about their artwork that inspired you when you first read it?
Well, the Bisley stuff was, I just found it absolutely incredible. I just couldn't believe that there was this kind of painted quality of work that was in a weekly magazine. And because up to that point, I mean, I wasn't really steeped in comics when I was growing up. I think the comic I read most was Asterix and sort of the occasional American comic when I was on holiday and stuff like that. And that's all the local shop had. But seeing Bisley's fully painted stuff was just amazing. And sort of I like painting and I thought, crikey, well, this is a feasible job. so that's my entry in. And then obviously sort of looking at his work and then reading interviews with him and finding out his influence, like Bill Sienkiewicz and stuff like that, and then looking at his work and you think, crikey, there's a whole, this fully painted sort of side of comics is quite amazing.
Really. Yeah. Now, I mean, that's fascinating because you, of course, have gone on to be a great portrait painter, exhibited at the National Gallery, and you're in the Royal Institute as well.
Royal Portrait Society.
There you go.
Vice President.
Wow. Yeah. Who would have thought that one day a 2000 AD artist would be the Vice President?
I know.
To a certain extent, would you say that something like Bisley's Slane is what pushed you down this route, inspired you to go on to become a painter?
Absolutely, yeah. Right. I mean, it's quite funny because all the sort of comic artists I really like the American artists like Sienkiewicz and John Muss and Kent Williams. Kent Williams particularly, he's moved completely into fine art painting or portraiture or whatever. And there was another painter whose comics I really liked, who did a lot of stuff for Epic Illustrated, Phil Hale. He's moved into painting completely. So I could see that the move from comics to painting is not a completely obscure one. So it wasn't exactly a plan, but it's sort of like a logical progression. And the thing is, I love comics so much, and particularly working for Two Tao, so I didn't want to ditch one in favour of the other. So I have this sort of quite nice little
dual
balance.
Life.
And I really love it, actually. It's great.
It's a Venn diagram that I don't think many people would assume existed, that kind of fine art comics.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love it. When I'm, you know, I think doing the same thing all the time is, I've always sort of, I mean, always struggled with slightly. So when I'm sort of doing comics, I sort of thinking about painting, and then when painting, thinking about comics, and that's quite a nice thing to do. It reminds me of when I used to have jobs, just sort of like graphic design jobs, and which I hated. And then I used to get home and then work on my comic portfolio to send in to David Bishop. And there's something really beautiful about that time when you're prevented from doing what you really want to do, and you have to, and there's something else in the way. But and so that time is really precious when you're actually doing it.
Yeah.
And so in a way, this sort of dual career thing is my way of doing that, which I really really quite like.
Excellent. So. Well, let's talk about your take on Slain, which is a bit of a different take than Clint Langley, who was your predecessor on the strip, whereas his was involved a lot of photo manipulation in terms of his execution, but also in terms of his portrayal of Slain. His was a very gruff, big, stocky wide man almost, but with your Slain, as you say, he's more world weary. He's a bit slimmer, and it has been pointed out there is a slight resemblance to somebody I may or may not be sat in the stand booth with.
There is a slight resemblance, and it's just my way of giving myself a six pack and hair. I think when we were talking about. Pat and I were talking about what sort of Slain we were going to try and do, because every artist has brought their different sort of different slant to the character, and I really like McMahon's sort of like a gangly, slightly
like a
feral
live.
Bloke, and then Bisley is quite muscly, and then Glenn's was like a pop star sort of guy, and that was great, but it was, and I just thought I'd quite like it just to be sort of just realistic, really, not particularly muscly, because I always thought that was pretty ridiculous. You know what, I don't want to get too analytical about it, always think, well, why would he be incredibly muscly? He'd just be big, like, say, scaffolder or something. His body is how it is through what he does, rather than sit-ups and
it doesn't strike me as one for sit-ups, really.
No so that was the thinking behind that, and there's just a little bit older, really. I mean, and I don't know if I don't know if Pat's ever particularly worried about the continuity of from story to story about because they can exist on their own as a standalone thing. So I don't think there's any kind of progressive aging or timeline to any of this sort of stuff. So we just sort of thought this is what we'll do for this one.
And how, because you've done the first series, which was A Simple Killing, and now with Primordial, how have you changed and adapted to the way that Pat's storytelling has changed? Because it seems as if he's quite energised by this new direction.
Yeah, I think so. We wanted it to, or I suggested that we have it sort of quite a lot more earthier, and he's definitely sort of, trudging around the sort of the countryside of the Isle of Man and stuff like that. And I think that's what we wanted it to be a little bit. It's almost sort of like he was sort of getting to the twilight of his life, and he was sort of stripped down, and there's no sort of echo with him or anything, so he's on his own, and I quite like that sort of pale rider kind of thing that he was, I think Pat's been sort of quite energised by it, and I've from what I've spoken to him or emailed him, he seems pretty happy with how it's all going.
You've kind of let loose on a lot of the big splash pages, you've been working for 2000 AD, as you say, for over 20 years now, and you've worked on Dread, you've worked on Sinister Dexter, even recent stories like Damnation Station and Ant Me Crucius. But it does feel like you've kind of put your foot to the floor on this.
The thing is, it was when I started, it was intimidating, because there's such this weight of these great artists who've all worked on it, and to start with, I was just worried about damage limitation. I could really fuck this up. But after, you know, as soon as I got the script through and talking to Pat, and it was just great. And I've always struggled with sort of the sci-fi element of Tooth Owl.
Right.
Me being able to do it. I just can't do anything.
What, in a sci-fi action comic?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a bad move. So, and, you know, I look at, say, Henry's stuff or...
Henry Flint.
Yeah, Flint stuff. And you just think, God, he's absolutely suited to this. He's just brilliant at it. It makes it look fantastically effortless.
Yeah.
And I just absolutely rubbish at it.
So
to do something that was no straight lines and earth and trees and grass and mud and stuff, you know, so this is probably the most suited I am to a strip. So, but I've been lucky with the stuff I've done with, say, Ian Eddington and Dan Abnett.
Yeah,
the Cruces stuff has been really enjoyable and. Hopefully we'll get to go back to that at some stage, but I think Slane just does seem to have given us all a bit of a jolt, myself and Pat. So we're all quite excited about it.
And have you talked to Pat about the direction of where you're going and whether there's a conclusion to it? Or
well, I think this book Primordial is the second one, and there's a third one planned. So I'm not absolutely sure where that's going, but then I quite like that in a way because it gets me excited about doing it.
But
it's good, and the nice thing about this particular story is I've been sort of doing, like you said, a lot of double page spreads and things like that, but I've also tried to make sure that the covers I've done are all oil paintings as well, so I've been able to bring that side of what I do as well into comics, which has been really fun, actually. It's been quite a nice thing to do.
It's spectacular seeing you bring them into the office on a regular basis. One of only two artists who still do that. And particularly the ones that you've brought in for Primordial as far as I'm concerned, really sort of knocking it out of the park.
Well, that's very kind of you. Hopefully it just shows that I'm just really enjoying it, and I am in. Yeah, it's been absolutely great. I mean, it's fantastic, and it probably is taking a lot longer than I usually take to deliver work. I just feel like there's some weight of longevity about it, so I have to. I feel like I have to sort of really put a lot of effort into it, which is. You know, it's not a hardship, that's fine.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the 2018 Showcast, Simon. So we're going to continue chatting about Slane, the Britannia Chronicles with, what greater guest could we possibly have on the 2018 Thrillcast than the creator of 2018 himself and the creator of Slane, Mr. Pat Mills. Pat, welcome to the Thrillcast.
Hi, Michael. Hi.
So we're talking about Slane the Britannia Chronicles, which is now running in 2000 AD. Tell me a bit about, in your own words, what the Britannia Chronicles is and what Primordial is. Where are we with Slane at the moment?
Well, I suppose the Britannia Chronicles are a kind of new departure for Slane to a certain degree. In as much as, he's a little older now, a little more world-weary, and Ukko doesn't really feature. Ukko's his companion, his dwarf companion. And the logic behind it goes something like this, that there are these astonishing legends about Britain and how it was... originally occupied, invaded by Trojans.
Yeah.
And London was originally called New Troy. Mm. And the king of the Trojans was Brutus, Emperor Brutus.
Mm.
So from a fantasy writer's point of view, that's an incredible gift. And the astonishing thing is, you know, why hasn't anybody else ever featured Trojans running amok in Britain before, because you know, hey, they look like these sort of characters out of the film 300. Mm. You know, they've got those kind of sinister helmets, you know, that the Greeks, the Spartans have. So visually, they're very striking. There's a lot more to the series than just these sort of rather nasty foreign invaders. But that, if you like, was my starting point for creating the Britannia Chronicles.
Okay, now, you mentioned it's a departure there, and also the absence of Uku. What kind of Slane are we dealing with here? Because obviously he's been through quite a few incarnations over the years, where he's been wanderer, he's been a kind of teenage misfit. He's also had these great time traveling adventures. Who is Slane in this story?
Well, I think that the common factor with all these stories is exploring ancient myths, rather than creating a totally new fantasy world, as in, say, Game of Thrones. It's drawing on the original myths and legends of Britain and Ireland. So that's the common denominator that runs through the different points in his life. Mm. Where he is different now, I suppose, is because you know, he's had all these past experiences. But one thing that's equally important is, I don't want him to be weighed down by them, because I think sometimes characters who've been around for a very long time can be weighed down by their past, by preconceptions about them, and so on. And so I see it as featuring Britain, featuring the Trojans, and also this bizarre island based on the Isle of Man, which I'll come on to a little bit later. You know, that's all new material. It's looking for new fantasy angles that we haven't featured before on Slane. And apart from the ones I've mentioned, there are others as well. The giants, for example. Mm. Now, I've held back for a long time featuring giants in Slane, because if they can look rather young, or they can look, a little derivative of a certain art look that's been around for a while. But I think Simon has come up with a great look for them. They really look very impressive and very convincing.
Let's talk about Simon's artwork, because the stuff he's producing for this series is absolutely stunning, and you seem reinvigorated by his art. Is that the case?
Well, I'm always actually invigorated by every Slane artist, because I think Slane steals a bit of each artist's soul, and you know. I think Slane has got quite a few artist scalps on his belt. So what happens is you look at the way that the artist sees Slane, and then you respond to that accordingly. So Simon, for example, is a big fan of an artist called Toppi, T-O-P-P-I.
Yeah.
And he is a great artist. His style, arguably, is somewhat illustrative, and therefore you probably only end up with maybe, I don't know, two or three pictures on a page, and they're stunning. They really are stunning. But for the purposes of what you might call British picture strip, we need to have an element of Toppi, and then we need to combine it with other things. So, if you'd like. I think what's different about this particular Slane is it's giving a lot of space to the artist to have these, you know, wide fantasy scenes. Now, of course, there has to be good subject matter for that to work. There's some sensational center spreads. So it's always getting a balance between providing these kind of cinematic shots, you know, where you really are going to the movies with Simon's artwork, and also at the same time telling a story. In other words, so that the story doesn't move too slowly. In other words, so each week you've got a strong sense of story progression, plot progression, and character development.
You've said to me in the past that this is some of your favourite Slane artwork since Simon Bisley's work on The Horned God. Is that something you still feel as the series has progressed?
Well, yeah. I mean, I love all the Slane artists. And, I mean, you know, Clint Langley's art brought Slane back from a fairly weak point somewhere around about the millennium. But I think for... fans of painted art, and I think we were all spoilt rotten by Simon Bisley's Horned God. I mean, my God, you know, getting Frazetta on every page.
Yeah.
And I think there was a sense after that was, well, come on, 2008, you've got to keep this coming every week. And some of the artists who followed were in a bit of a no-win situation. I think many of them did actually deliver. But it really was, I think, like we'd all been in a sweet shop and we were cluttered on this amazing stuff. So it, arguably, I think for many people, you know, Simon's Britannia Chronicles has that rich quality that Simon's had, and there were others who provided that as well. Dermot Power on Treasures of Britain, for instance. But even so, in terms of the fact that this is a big saga with a lot of emotion, a lot of conflict going on, it does bear comparison with the Horned God, I think, and at the same time, it also feels quite contemporary in Simon's style. Simon Davis, it's yeah. Kind of confusing, isn't it, with the two Simons, yeah.
And you've talked about the myths and legends about Albion and the invasion of the Troys and Brutus and whatnot. Slane's been around for almost as long as 2000 AD. Why have you only just got to this great big section of mythology now, after all these years?
Well, I think it was sort of set up at the beginning. You know, I was aware that this whole world of Britannia was there. I think to a certain extent. Well, first of all, there were many Irish stories that needed to be told first. In fact, there still are one or two Irish sagas that I haven't touched upon. But I think to make this particular story work, Slane had to be alone. Because when he was with Ukko, Ukko would steer the stories down a particular path. Usually it would be some sort of criminal action and so on. But, you know, Slane's kind of grown up a bit. He's moved on from his, youthful indiscretions and so forth. But he still has that that capacity to be a rebel, to be an outsider. But he is at the same time that little bit more sophisticated. So I think all those things came in, you know, come into it in terms of why not before, and also the fact that the British legend of the Emperor Brutus, there isn't that much material on it, so you know, it's not like here's a ready-made story, and that's possibly why other writers haven't touched it before, to my knowledge, because all you've got are just a few references in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of Britain, where he refers to Brutus and so on. And there are a few vestiges of what is allegedly the Trojan invasion. I think you have these what do they call them, Troy towns, a sort of maze, a Troy maze of some description, which there are allegedly remnants of in parts of Britain. But yeah, the, you know, one really had to think about it, because, for instance, I mean, if you go back to the story of the Trojans in Greece, you know, apart from the, you know, there's the famous story, the wooden horse and, you know, Helen of Troy and so on. But there actually isn't that much about the Trojans themselves by comparison with the Spartans. And that's why, you know, you have these films like 300, and there have been others before them. So, yeah, you have to build on the few fragments that are available.
Was there anything, whether British history or Irish history in the past, where you've looked at it and you've thought, I can't possibly put this in, this is far too ridiculous?
Well, often with Irish legends, they veer off into fantasy in a way that Nordic legends do not. Mm. And I think that's... I mean, you can see it in terms of movies that, you know, you have movies about Beowulf or Vikings and things. But characters like Cú Chulainn, on whom, you know, Slane is very much inspired by, you know, there hasn't been a film about him. Because, you know, it's to do with really the fact that Nordic and also Greek and Roman legends are quite ordered, they're quite structured. Mm. And Irish legends are all over the place. And that's what gives them their charm, because it's such a, it's still, you know, reflected in modern Irish character. It's very, very left field. But it means that they're not as accessible or as immediately accessible as, you know, the sort of Beowulf kind of stories. Mm. But once you get into them, they're that much more rewarding. And of course, that's why, you know, Slane has succeeded over the years, because, you know, the readers, I think, are fascinated by the weirdness of Celtic society and the fact that it is reflected in a kind of modern anti-establishment attitude, and it's something really valuable to draw on. And so that's why I'm all the time looking for new ways to bring that out.
Now, it wouldn't be a Pat Mills story if there wasn't a message behind it. What for you, what's the message behind A Simple Killing and Primordial, the two books in the series so far?
Well, I suppose it's more of the same, I guess, to start with. Well, I mean, you know, there's any number of subtexts to it, because I think, you know, I'm very suspicious of authors who say, oh, no, this whole thing is fantasy. It has no meaning or relevance to today. I mean, yeah, right. You know, you're just keeping that very close to your chest, aren't you? Yeah, I mean, of course, what you have here is... an imperialist power, and you have the Celts with Slane at the center of it, being the what's often described as the eternal other, in other words, the opposition. So that's there, but there's much more beside. A very quick shorthand way of describing it would be the activities on the Isle of Man, where, you know, our old favourite villains are, the Droon Lords, who I think have always been the most successful bad guys in Slane. And they are carrying out what we would regard today as genetic experiments. Mm. A quick way of describing that would be it's a kind of Island of Dr. Moreau. But, you know, that's only because I'm trying to save time here by not going into every inch of the plot. It's exploring that's new, that hasn't been done in Slane. And I'm not even sure, I'm just thinking about it, as far as I'm aware, the whole subject of changing people's sort of genetic destiny, mutations and so on, I don't think it's really been covered in heroic fantasy, certainly not in this way. Mm. For anyone who's into the author, just looking at him on my bookshelf here, I think he's called Zechariah Sitchin. They're quite dry books, but alongside many other authors, it works on the principle that humanity has been changed at some point in our past. In other words, we're not right, which I think everyone would agree with that. So we've been messed around with in some way because we have these sudden evolutionary leaps where we make these supposed leaps forward. Mm. So it's exploring that in an interesting way, I feel. That's they're using sorcery, whereas if this was a science fiction story, everyone would be the subject of rather nasty science fiction experiments. So obviously, the story takes a very negative view of such events. But it's quite different and fresh. And it also, there's one last thing that's explored, which has been referred to in book one and starts to come through in Primordial, which is a subject of other legends. It'd take a little bit of time to really go into where they come from, but it's certainly a belief amongst a number of people that we are, if you like, the property of some kind of alien beings or other. I mean, Charles Fort says it in Book of the Damned. He says, I believe we're owned by someone, by some race. I believe we're property. Why don't they communicate with us? Well, do we have an embassy for chickens or cattle? The answer's no. So it's exploring that, but also exploring the idea that whoever owns us may in turn actually be the loser in some kind of battle. You couldn't really use a word like galactic battle because that conjures up Star Wars, but some kind of celestial conflict, shall we say. And so that's featured here for the first time, picking up on a story thread that was established a long, long time ago when the sort of demons called the Sith were first featured with Glenn Fabry's artwork. Mm. Readers who are really into tight continuity might well be saying, at last he's going to explain that. So that's covered as well. Mm. The idea that these demons, the Sith, are themselves actually on a kind of prison planet. So that all adds to the tone of the story and the subtext and what's going on.
Okay, well, we've run out of time to talk more about Slane, the Britannia Chronicles. So I want to thank you, Pat, very much for coming on the Thrillcast, and hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Thanks very much, Michael. Cheers.
Cheers. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on the 2000 AD Thrillcast this week. Earthlitz, thanks very much to Matt, Cy and Pat for joining us. And I hope you've enjoyed the new 2000 AD Thrillcast. Do let us know your thoughts on what you'd like us to feature and who you'd like to hear from. Email us thrillcast@2000adonline.com or tweet us on the Twitters @2000AD. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our web shop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Splundig ver Thrig, Earthlets!